Hello and welcome to this encore episode of the Psychology Talk podcast. Welcome to the Psychology Talk podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Scott Hoy. The Psychology Talk podcast is a unique conversation about psychology from around the globe. We bring you ideas from mental health practitioners and experts to keep you informed about the latest issues and trends. Topics include developments and research in psychotherapy and social sciences, hypnosis and mind-body treatments, meditation and spirituality, and new treatment modalities. And while you're listening, please take a moment to subscribe and give us a review at your favorite streaming site. It helps us to grow and further reach people with quality programming. And now, here's the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Psychology Talk podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. Stanley Krippner. Dr. Krippner has held faculty appointments at Akami University, Fordham University, Kent State University, New York University, Saybrook University, Sophia University, and the California Institute for Integral Studies, where he currently holds the position of Affiliated Distinguished Faculty. He is a fellow in five divisions of the American Psychological Association and the past president of two divisions, the Society of Psychological Hypnosis and the Society of Humanistic Psychology. Formerly, he was the director of the Maimonides Medical Center Dream Research Laboratory in Brooklyn, New York, and earlier, the director of the Kent State University Child Center in Kent, Ohio. Today, we are happy to discuss with Dr. Krippner a new book he has co-authored, Understanding Suicide's Allure, Steps to Save Lives by Healing Psychological Scars. Dr. Krippner, thank you for being on the Psychology Talk podcast. Tell us a little bit about this book, The Allure of Suicide.
Well, the four of us are interested in the topic because our lives have been affected by friends and family members who have taken their own lives. And so we decided to do an investigation to answer some of our questions, even though, as I say, we're not professional suicidologists. So this was an education for me and the other members of our group. And hopefully it'll be of use to the people who read it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I was reading through the book, I kind of was noting to myself that I was finding it to be a rich treasure trove of research and case studies and integrated perspectives about treatment modalities. And it seems like it would be good required reading for a lot of professionals or just even people interested in the mainstream to normalize this thing called suicide, which is taboo, and especially in Western societies, it's very disruptive, I think, because we don't really look at death in general. We kind of have a taboo at looking at death, especially in modern Western dominant cultures.
Well, I think you're right. And the whole topic of death, including suicide, is very often ignored and even repressed, not only by individuals, but by the media and other institutions. Now, you can take contrast to other societies, more indigenous societies. Some of them handle death better, some of them handle death worse, but they do provide us with a number of new models, such as death being a transition, death being a celebration, death being a memorial, putting death into a larger context, and that sort of takes the murky subset of death out of the picture and replaces it with something maybe not more cheerful, but at least something more positive.
Yeah, as opposed to a dead end or zero-sum game of life versus not being alive. Yeah, yeah. Maybe you could kind of step into an exploration of how suicide has touched your life and how it spurred on as an impetus for taking on this project with your co-authors.
Oh, good heavens. The other my co-authors are all clinical psychologists and psychotherapists.
Yeah.
And I am not, and don't pretend to be. But what I contributed along the lines of what you're talking about, there are little cameo sketches of half a dozen friends of mine who took their own lives. Mm-hmm. And some of those suicides affected me very, very deeply. And in retrospect, I could have seen some of them coming. But then on the other hand, I don't think that I could have done much about reversing the direction, because I was not a part of the context and the background that led to the suicidal actions. And I think this is something for your viewers and listeners to keep in mind. Don't blame yourself if a loved one ends their own life. Don't feel guilty, because more likely than not, there's nothing that you personally could have done, except maybe to get them to phone in the suicide hotline, which is a valuable resource which has saved numerous lives. But telling a suicide-prone person to take the suicide hotline often leads to resentment and anger, because people are sort of denying to themselves a lot of their suicidal impulses.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a dual narrative in their minds, one that's the repressed or suppressed narrative of ending it all or escaping some sort of mental prison that's painful, and seeing the only possible solution as suicide.
Well, that's a good way to put it. Now, you ask how it's affected my own life. The most recent case was when I was working at Saybrook University. We had a receptionist who was suicide prone. I didn't know it at the time, but we had a delightful relationship, and she was happy and cheerful as far as I knew. And then somebody stole her purse. And that triggered off a deep depression. Again, this is like chaos theory, which we described. In chaos theory, one little incident can unleash a whole variety of sequel behaviors, some of them very, very serious. Anyway, once her purse was stolen and not returned, she went to deep depression. She went to the Golden Gate Bridge and jumped off. Sad story. Well, that was a shock to me. And again, I was asking myself, didn't I see this coming? No, I did not see it coming. And this is very often the case. Many suicide-prone people put up a good front, and they maintain that front up to the time that they die.
Yeah.
Oh, I could go on and on. I had a... when I was living in Wisconsin, I was an active member of the local Presbyterian church, and one of the younger members of the church, who I didn't know all that well, but I did know his parents, and I knew that there was a lot of spouse abuse, because his mother would come in with black and blue marks on her face from time to time. And he went to the pastor for counseling, and the pastor didn't have a background in suicidology, and he said, just pray harder. Well, praying harder didn't do it. And within the month, he had shot himself and killed himself. Very, very sad. Yeah. I've had other poignant experiences like that in terms of people who I was connected with one way or the other, who suicided.
Hmm. Yeah. And of course, this brings up and elicits a whole number of emotional responses in us, the survivors.
Well, it does. A lot of people who suicide don't realize how many people are affected by their action. According to one survey, the average suicide person, when he or she dies, there are close to 100 people affected one way or another, mostly negatively. That's a lot of people. And, of course, this goes beyond family members, and it even affects people that they might not have known all that well. But a lot of people are affected by a suicide.
Yes, I can recall peripheral individuals. One incident when I was a teenager, my sister's neighbor suicided. He completed suicide by hanging himself in his house, and it affected the entire neighborhood. And not only my nephews and nieces and my sister and brother-in-law, but the entire neighborhood was affected by it. And I don't think that individual meant to affect them in such a way. I think he obviously was going through a lot of pain at the time. But I think you're right. I think that there is this kind of, it's almost like dropping a rock into a still body of water, and it has such a ripple effect. Yeah.
Yes, you're so right. You're so right, yes. Yeah.
Well,
the one case in the book where I think I might have made a difference was not all that long ago, maybe 20 years ago or so, when a young man I know and who I could sense was borderline personality did some work for me in my office and enjoyed hanging out with me. And I knew that he was, as I say, borderline. I didn't know that he was suicidal. But one day he came in with his hand-carved staff and gave it to me, which was a wonderful gift. And then I checked with his girlfriend. He'd given her another one of his prized possessions. And then he went off and shot himself. Well, of course, I knew that giving away possessions is sometimes a sign of suicide. A person wants to make sure that their prized possessions are in the hands of somebody that will take care of them. And it's sort of like a little ritual they go through before they take their own lives. And I think that this is maybe something your viewers and listeners might keep in mind. This is a symptom, a possible symptom of suicide. Without warning or without explanation, somebody starts to give away valuable, or at least sentimental value, physical items and articles.
Mm. Almost like a house cleaning.
Almost, yes, a good comparison.
A house cleaning before leaving the house, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what do you think makes suicide so alluring? I mean, the title itself is alluring and intriguing, but why do you collectively, the authors, give that title to the book?
Yes, yes. I think that you inadvertently gave the reason a few minutes ago. Of course, as a clinical psychologist, you're dealing with these issues constantly. And so when you said she didn't seem to have any way out, that is an excellent phrase. Yeah, the average suicide person does not see an alternative. And the more that they think about this, become obsessed with it, There's no other way out. And then when there is an opportunity, they will grab it. What do I mean, an opportunity? Well, in the case of the secretary, Golden Gate Bridge was not too far away for her to make the trip. In case of the guy who was going to church with me, his father had guns in the house and didn't have a good way of locking them or putting them away for safety. So when this guy wanted to kill himself, he just took one of his father's guns. So in terms of prevention, we deal with this in the book, limiting access to potentially harmful weapons is something that friends and relatives of a suicide-prone person should take to heart. The plethora of weapons in our society, of course, is astonishing. There are now more guns in the United States than people. And so if somebody is hell-bent on killing themselves, there are a lot of opportunities, not in terms of not only guns, but other weapons around the house. Mm-hmm. And again, as we stay in the book, suicide is complicated. And every suicide is a little bit different. And when I started to deal with this matter and recount the instances of friends of mine who'd taken their own lives, I could see that each one of them had a different scenario. Each one had a very, very different story. And at the end, they all led up to the conclusion, after not, there's no other way out. And this is the allure. The allure says, look, there's no other way out. Come to me and your problems will disappear. And it's almost as if suicide to them is a seductive man or woman and leading them on to take their own lives.
Yeah. Well, it's almost as if they're taking a cue from Jean-Paul Sartre, right? Like, no exit, the play, no exit. There's no way out, but the courage of life. Yeah, the courage of life is they're not meeting the next step, which would be the courage to sit with it, probably because of the immense amount of psychological pain.
Well, you're so right, and maybe some of your viewers don't know about No Exit. This is a celebrated play by the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. I've seen the play, as a matter of fact. And Jean-Paul Sartre, of course, was a pioneer existential writer, and our book is very firmly rooted in the psychology of existential thought, as well as other psychological perspectives. But in existentialism, one is committed to make a decision. And encouraging people to make the right decision, of course, is a task of psychotherapists such as yourself. And when they make their own decision, this empowers them. Many suicide-prone people think, no, I have no power. I'm impotent. There's no way out. No exit. And therapists, friends, relatives, hotlines, etc., need to convince that person, no, there are alternatives. There are other behaviors that you can commit yourself to.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned these kind of symbols of a seductress or a seductor, right? A femme fatale or a strong man, so to speak, to take care of all the problems. It reminds me of when one of my patients years ago, when I was working in drug and alcohol centers, who he described his relationship with heroin as an escape, but also as like the most consistent relationship that gave him the feelings he wanted, almost like his girlfriend. Unfortunately, maybe I'm incorrect in this, but he, weeks later, when he was discharged and living in a halfway house, took his one last trip with his girlfriend, and that was the end of his life, which, of course, sent those shockwaves out into everyone else who was at the office and the other patients in the setting. It's very, very rough, very traumatic. But it reminds me, you do go at length into one indicator, possible indicator, subconscious indicator of what a suicide, of clues that suicide prone people might have, and that would be in their dreams. And the imagery in dreams are the kind of themes that come up.
Oh, absolutely. As you know, we devote a whole chapter of our book to suicide and dreams. Yes, people who keep dream diaries, if they share those with people, one can see the symptoms of suicidal behavior in their dreams. Why? Because dreams serve many purposes. They help us solve problems. They help us store memories. They help us plan for the future. And as a result, thoughts of suicide are bound to show up one way or another in dreams because they're highly emotional, these thoughts of suicide. And again, one of the functions of dreams is to help us process our emotions, to work through the emotions and the dreams that we haven't dealt with during the day. So experts can look at dream diaries and they can spot the signs of suicide. And one doesn't only have to do this with dreams. There are a number of tests one can take, if one is so disposed, by a trained psychologist. And these tests are geared to elicit answers, either spoken answers or written answers, to a number of situations or even a number of word associations. And suicide people do have some characteristic patterns in their responses. And this is something which was unheard of 20 years ago or even less. But now we have artificial intelligence. We have ways of scanning verbal content and doing content analysis of them. And so a person who is suicidal, if they have the fortune to run into a psychotherapist who's able to administer these tests, the severity of their suicidal tendencies can be spotted. And I think this is the positive aspect that comes into our book. Yeah, people are using innovative approaches to create what's called algorithms, mathematical formulae that can predict behavior. And I think that the more that this knowledge is disseminated, especially to psychotherapists such as yourself, but also to other people, counselors, even teachers, even family members, they can sort of guess what's coming. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that half the people who suicide never go to a therapist or a counselor or a pastor or a priest or anybody else who could give them some help. The 50% who do go to somebody to help, most of them do not go to a person who's been trained in suicidology. And so sometimes the session does more harm than good. Like my church-going friend who went to the pastor and was told to pray harder, I think maybe that advice did more harm than good. He prayed harder, nothing happened. He thought, God has forsaken me, or maybe God is calling me, and then that did it. He took his own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we are prepared as psychotherapists and clinical psychologists and psychiatrists to work with these issues. But also, I wonder how much has changed in suicidology over the years. I mean, most people get out and go into their respective field or into their silos. And I wonder how much it would be helpful for all of us practicing out there in various silos or clinics to actually, you know, have a reckoning with these algorithms, with these ways of helping as well.
I think that this is an excellent point. And as you know from the book, I'm a member of the American Association for Suicidology, and we just had our annual convention. I listened in by Zoom, fortunately. And it's very encouraging to learn about all of the new research that's going on, all of the discussion of counseling and psychotherapeutic techniques. This is an organization, most of the members are, like yourself, clinical psychologists or psychiatrists or counselors. Very few people are in my position because I do not consider myself a suicidologist, but of course I'm eager to learn about the field, especially once the book has come out and I get questions from people such as yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it's certainly, this book is a great branching off spot for psychotherapists everywhere to look into this subject and have more clinical tools up our sleeves, so to speak, I think.
Well, you're so right. And of course, in the book, one of the things that I did was to track down the evidence. What were the evidence-based therapies that help suicide-prone people? And of course, cognitive behavioral therapy comes out as an evidence-based therapy. And one of my co-authors, Debbie Ellis, the wife of Albert Ellis, the founder of cognitive behavioral therapy back in the 1950s, writes several chapters of the book. But also there's unusual approaches, such as the eye movement technique, EMDR, mm-hmm. which surprisingly enough does prove to be clinical effective for most of the people who go that route. And we've taken up various therapies at various age levels. And then, of course, we have a lot of emphasis on suicide in various ethnic groups, because suicides in Native American populations are surprisingly high, sad to say. And there's also a lot of suicide-prone people in Black populations, Asian populations, and Latinx populations. So I think this is something unique about our book. We do look into the various differences in terms of ethnicity, but also income. Income plays a role in suicidology. A lot of people in society now are talking about critical race theory and such controversial topics. Where's critical income theory? I think that we have a greater class problem in the United States than we have race problems. Class differences are often shoved under the table.
Well, I think that they get subsumed by a narrative that's more readily agreeable with those who hold the power in the media, which would be corporations, people, the 1%. I'm not against people being wealthy at all. I'm not picking on the 1%, but I think you're right. I think that obviously there is a social economic status that we all fall into. It's pretty much well known that somewhere between $70,000 and $90,000 a year is going to make you fairly efficacious within the economy, maybe not greatly, it depends. And that bar keeps getting lifted as inflation goes up over the years. But most of us don't fit into that that SES. Most of us are below that, or you know, very few of us are above that. And we don't look at it as something that's real. It's probably most people would consider that bordering on socialism, or God forbid, communism, if you just speak truth to power about like critical income theory. That's a very good way to put it. I think that the majority of our woes that are beleaguering society today are the destruction of the middle class through, I guess, economic, I would almost say, a friend of mine calls it economic fascism. It's kind of a hard pill to swallow, but it is just a lack of consideration of how, if you're going to have a fiat currency driving a society, you have to make sure that people can use that fiat currency to feel comfortable, raise children, feel that they're some sort of teleological forward movement in their life, that they have some kind of goals, meaning in their life. If you don't have money, money doesn't give you meaning, but it certainly can be a bedrock for the consistency in your life that can cause meaning.
Oh, you're so right. And you stated it better than I did.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'll get off my soapbox now.
No problem. No problem at all. Yeah. As you know, the book came out once the pandemic had started. Mm-hmm. And while the book was still in press, I pulled together a preface for the book.
Yes.
And my co-authors added to it. And so in the preface, we note the pandemic and we note some of the possible danger signs. What's going to happen when people are cloistered at home and have to deal with family members 24 hours a day? Sometimes this adds to family cohesiveness and together. And other times people realize that they really can't stand each other, or that other people are getting on their nerves, and they go into anger, into depression, into domestic violence. And we see that being played out, that the pandemic can bring out the best in families, but also bring out the worst in families. So I think that's a unique feature of our book.
Oh, I think so. I mean, maybe you can even address that, if not statistically. I think everybody has been suffering through this pandemic to greater degrees or lesser degrees, but I think most people's lives have been upended. I think on the positive note, many people are climbing off of the hamster trail wheel, you know, the hamster habit trail wheel of work, sleep, and actually finding that there are other things out there, slowing down the as Robert Heinlein called it, the busy, 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 right? Of mm-hmm. Valentine Michael Smith, I think was the character's name. We are slowing it down, which is wonderful. But at the same time, you can start to see the cracks in the system, including your own home system.
Oh, that's just so well put. You're right. And during the pandemic, rich people in our country even got richer through one way or another.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
The disparity, the class disparity, has gotten worse as a result of the pandemic. And these economic differences, of course, are things that you and other psychotherapists run into and deal with in your practice. I might also mention something unique about our book that no other suicide book has, probably because it's so recent. We devote two chapters to psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy.
Yes, I was intrigued by that.
And, you know, it is working. We have an entire chapter on ayahuasca and how ayahuasca, which is a drink made from vines that grow in the jungle that have mind-altering properties, mm-hmm. that when ayahuasca is used in a therapeutic session, it actually reduces suicide ideation, thoughts of suicide. Again, more research needs to be done, but we present what's there as well as some case studies. And then we have another chapter on psilocybin and other psychedelics its role in psychotherapy, and psilocybin, which is a synthesis of ingredients from so-called magic mushrooms, psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy has already racked up a track record of being superior to conventional drugs in terms of treating depression.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly, I see a tectonic shift coming as long as clinicians are on the ball with the integration of these medications properly, and the psychiatric community takes them up in a way that allows for that integration rather than tweaking a molecule here and there and just like writing a script, seeing patients every 15 minutes and writing a script. And, you know, I do see a lot of work in that direction. For instance, there's a company, Journey Clinical, is rolling out kind of a nationwide support system for medication now with ketamine because it's available, and psychiatrists and psychotherapists. So it's not the typical IV drip, but it's sublingual that's used in coordination with longer term sessions to work through that dissociative drug, work through depression, anxiety, PTSD.
Oh, that's very well stated. I first found out about psychedelics over 50 years ago. And once I had my own psilocybin session, I began following up what was happening in the field. And of course, as you know, back in the 1960s, the government took away the legitimate psychedelic supplies from researchers, including those who I knew, and it went underground. And I thought, oh my God, what a shame. This is a wonderful psychotherapeutic tool, and now it's lost. Well, I had to wait almost half a century to see the renaissance in psychedelics, and I'm glad I lived long enough to see them coming into their own at last.
I heartily agree. I know that is it, am I correct in assuming years ago, I was on vacation with the family, visiting my wife's family in India. I read a copy of the Siren Song.
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah. Someone I'm speaking to right now wrote that years ago, but I think you went into detail about your psilocybin experience. And was that with Richard Alpert and Timothy Leary? Is that right?
It was actually with a student of Timothy Leary's.
Okay.
And I was in the very last legal psilocybin session that was done at Harvard.
Wow.
And I took psilocybin with my friend Steve Kleinberg, who's now a very famous sociologist at Rice University. And yes, we had a very stunning time. I wrote up the experience and read the autobiography. I have to write that up again because now a publisher wants me to publish my memoirs. And so, of course, there's a chapter on my psilocybin experience and what came afterwards.
Yeah. Well, so this will be the second song of the Siren or something like that?
Oh, this will be better. I would have written Song of the Siren much differently today than I did back in those days.
Well, of course. Yeah. Hindsight's 20/20, right?
You bet.
So, kind of getting back to this suicide subject, maybe you can talk a little bit about the aspect of, which is in the media quite a bit now, bullying.
Well, this is one of the emphases of our book, by the way. We focus on three groups. Bullying is one of them. Sexual improprieties is another one. And war combat is the third. And all three of these groups are certainly at risk for suicide. And so we have, I think, pretty in-depth discussions as well as case histories to support this. I think that going back to bullying, one of the vignettes in the book is about a young man whose father literally bullied him to death. So bullying does not always come from peers. It can come from family members. And the father insisted nothing the son could do was good enough for the father. And if he brought home a B, the father said, next time bring an A. He brings him an A, the father says, next time bring an A+. Father was never satisfied. The father was convinced he was doing this for his son's own good, to make him tough, to motivate him. Worked just the opposite. And again, the father had weapons around the house, and the son found one of them and shot himself, and that was the end. Yeah, so bullying is something that is all too pervasive in our society. And of course, there are all sorts of people who are vulnerable to being bullied. People who have handicaps, people of color, people who are on the wrong end of the socioeconomic status. So there are risk groups for bullying. And this, of course, is one of the main themes in our book.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot has been said about veterans, which we can kind of get back to. But you mentioned LGBTQ folks and what they go through on a pretty consistent basis. And I don't think the book brought it up in particular, but when I work with clients from that population, they could be in their 70s. And I get a nose for this kind of internalized homophobia. And I'll try to work that up, even if they've gone through the process of outing themselves and being accepting of themselves for years. It's such a deep-seated sense of shame that people can live with in that population.
Oh, good heavens. We have a whole chapter in our book about this particular topic that you just mentioned, that among the groups that are very vulnerable are the not only the combat veterans, but in one study, veterans who were sent overseas but did not see combat were just as likely to have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as the veterans who had actually seen combat.
Mm.
So combat per se is not the most potent thing. It's how a person experiences the combat. And this is one of the themes in our book. We don't talk about a traumatic event. No, events are just what they are. And an event can be traumatizing. In other words, it can produce a traumatic experience. Now, experiences are different from events. Experiences are how a person reacts to the event. And if a person reacts to the event positively or neutrally, that's better than reacting to the event negatively. We use, for example, what happened in Vietnam, where a number of our soldiers were wittingly or unwittingly complicit in the death of civilians, even burning down houses, even shooting children who were carrying a doll thinking it was a bomb. And we forced the scenario. How can you talked about dreams a moment ago, and people who keep dreaming about killing this child, how can you change that dream positively? And the answer was, next time I have that dream, I'm going to apologize to the child and say, I'm going to take what I learned from my mistake and apply it to helping other children. Now, the way that you interject that into a dream, and we describe this in the book, is by dream incubation. During the day, you re-dream the dream over and over again with as much emotion as possible. And eventually, when you have that dream at night, you will have the different twist to it, the different ending to it. And once you start changing the dreams, the deep unconscious, then other things start to change too. And this can be the key to a whole resolution of the trauma. And PTSD is so pervasive in our society, We need all of the approaches that we can get. And in our book, as I say, we talk about the evidence-based psychotherapies and also introduce some of the promising things on the horizon, such as psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And we also, oh, good heavens, there are so many therapies, so many examples, I just don't know what one to pick. The most effective psychotherapy, by the way, was designed by a former student of mine, Rick Sword of Hawaii. And what he did was to focus on the way that people with PTSD experience time.
And yes. It was a temporal kind of,
That's right. And his book, Time-Focused Psychotherapy, is something that was put to an experimental test in Hawaii. And the veterans who went through time-focused psychotherapy got through it without a single suicide. And not a single person got worse. Some of them didn't get better. They stayed the same, but at least they didn't go downhill. So, yeah, there's a lot of very good psychotherapies out there. And the problem is getting people trained so they know what to do. It's very encouraging to see some of the schools I've worked with in the past, like New York University, California Institute of Integral Studies, now have whole programs training people to be psychedelic therapists.
Yes.
I just hope that when they finish the program, there'll be the jobs out there for them to fill. But I think this is amazing that there are now training programs for psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy at top-notch universities.
I totally agree. We need everything we can do to help people, and it shouldn't be about administering a drug and a cash per diem visit for money. It should be really about creating that healing space, right? I also think that these psychedelic therapies will probably bring back not just a renaissance of looking at plant medicines and derivatives of them to help us, but also to bring back what psychotherapy is, which is healing, a nice spacious area for you to feel comfortable to explore unwanted parts of yourself, ego states or self states or experiences that are kind of stuck in time, right? I think that that's it will humanize. Oddly enough, the medicines will probably humanize the psychotherapy. Not to say that it will, that psychotherapy will look like Rogerian therapy, but it would certainly humanize it and bring it back to that relational aspect.
Again, that's very well stated. And I think that this is underlined in our book because, like I say, we're working from an existential perspective. But this also brings in the existential elements in cognitive behavioral therapy and humanistic therapy and transpersonal therapy. And empowering a person is so important to keep that person from suiciding. And empowering a person can be done through counseling and psychotherapy, where a person eventually realizes, well, I'm in charge of my own life, and I have to take these particular steps, these changes in my behavior, these changes in my thought processes to keep functioning and to keep functioning better.
Yeah. Well, it's bringing, I think, attachment-oriented kind of psychotherapies that are essentially psychodynamic, but I think just attachment theory is kind of shown the test of time.
And oh, I think, good heavens.
Yeah.
It certainly has. The attachment theory, of course, is an outgrowth of psychoanalysis. And we do not spend a lot of time on psychoanalysis in the book, but we do talk about psychodynamic psychotherapy, which, mm-hmm. of course, is an outgrowth of psychoanalysis. And so I hope that we've covered the waterfront pretty well in terms of all fairly legitimate as well as some of the promising psychotherapies that are out there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think the book is a phenomenal title. I'm so happy to have read it and happy to have had this conversation about it.
I should mention one other thing, this being a Sunday after all.
Yeah.
In the section on transpersonal psychotherapy, we do not ignore a person's spiritual orientation, a person's spiritual beliefs.
Exactly.
And what a person believes about the hereafter, about life after death, or even about being kind to your neighbor, this can have a spiritual basis. And let's hope it's a positive spiritual basis. In our book, we talk about the Jonestown fiasco, the mass suicide of people who were led by Reverend Jim Jones. Mm-hmm. Right from San Francisco. I never knew Jim Jones, but I certainly read a lot about him and how he led most members of his cult in the country of Guyana, South America, to drink poison Kool-Aid and kill themselves. So spirituality is not a cure-all. Sometimes spirituality can take one in the wrong direction.
Oh, yeah, I think the book also discusses a case of spiritual abuse within psychedelic cults or things like that. Yeah, psychedelic experiences. Yeah.
Oh, good heavens, yes. You can't escape the specter of sexual abuse across the board. Yes, it happens with people who are psychotherapists, even psychedelic psychotherapists. It also happens with members of the clergy. And in our book, we have examples of this, not only Protestants and Catholics, but also more obscure spiritual groups in various parts of Latin America. And so under the veneer of being charitable and loving, a pastor or a member of what we say, a member of the cloth, can actually be diabolical.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to keep everyone has to keep a good, an eye out for their own demons, if you will. Yeah.
Oh, good heavens. Yes. We talking about sexual molestation. We have a chapter in the book telling the story of Gail Hansen, who was given this permission to use her own name, and how she was sexually molested by her dentist, of all people.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
And for years, she went into panic whenever she went to the dentist's office. And then a few years ago, she thought everything was under control. She understood herself. She knew what was coming, went to the dentist, and went into a panic. And so she had to retrace her steps and desensitize herself bit by bit from the early experience so she should go back to the dentist and finally have her teeth fixed.
Yeah, no, I've had incidents where I work with people with complex trauma who have explained that they were abused by their dentists when they were in their teens. It's horrible. I've had more than one case of that show up in my office. So I wasn't surprised to read that. I was happy to hear that she actually was able to work through it and be able to work through that trauma and integrate the lessons from it and be better, you know, to be more whole.
Absolutely. I think that, and again, your viewers and listeners can imagine this, a person in the dental chair is more or less trapped. And so if the dentist began to do inappropriate behavior, what could the person do? It might be an unacceptable risk to get out of the chair with all the paraphernalia on their bodies. And so it's like they're virtually trapped, and the molester sort of has a free rein, at least for a few minutes.
Yes, yes, yes. doesn't make me want to go to the dentist anytime soon now. But yes, and I'm sure it's happened more often than we would care to know. But the fact that it's being brought to the light of day and has been in the past is very important. So the book is really it is a treasure trove of information, and just it's in a way it's a good. It's a good soaking in it, right? You kind of like can absorb all the ideas and the concepts in it. And it really comes across as a very heartfelt attempt to solve a solution that is ever, ever growing, right? It seems in our society.
Oh, you're so right. This is why in the book we talk about suicide as a public health problem. Mm-hmm. It's no longer only an individual mission, only a family. No, what's suicide affects so many people. It's actually a public health problem, and we give our suggestions from that perspective.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And it affects everyone. The ripple effects of suicide are immense, just for our personal, for our souls, our psyches, and for the economy, and for on every level, top to bottom.
I think that one of the chapters in the book needs to be mentioned, and that's physician-assisted suicide. Hmm. Some people, at the end of their lives, have so many aches and pains and dysfunctional parts of their body, that suicide has a very special allure for them. And so we review the laws in the United States and overseas that either permit or do not permit physician-assisted suicide. And from my own personal experience, yes, I have two friends who are members of what we call Compassionate Choices. It's an organization that helps people find a physician to help them suicide, or how to suicide themselves with sort of a homemade toxic kit. And this is exactly what this dear friend of mine did. He was in his late 80s, was not functioning very well. And it's really too painful for me to go into a lot of details. But thank heavens that this organization helped him end his suffering and his misery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then the chapter goes into detail about the different ways one can kind of do end of life physician-assisted, more active, or just refusing of medications or whatnot. So, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anything else you'd like to say as we close up the conversation today?
Oh, good heavens. I'm just very, very grateful we've had this conversation, and you certainly have done your homework. You know the book so well, and so your questions are much more intelligent than the usual questions I get from people who talk to me about this topic. I think that the cultural antidote to suicide is for people to be kinder to each other and for diverse groups in the country to be kinder to each other. This kindness can cross religious, racial, ethnic, economic lines, because kindness has evolved to keep us where we are. Also in the book, you will notice that we look at things from an evolutionary point of view. We actually have some theories of suicide mm-hmm. by evolutionary psychologists, and it's taken millions of years for the human being to get to the point where the human being has self-awareness. And this self-awareness can lead to wonderful things. But the self-awareness can also make a person aware of the impossibilities of their life, the possibility there is no way out, and this can add to the allure of suicide. So, from an evolutionary point of view, these people drop out and their genes do not go into the gene pool. So why do we still have so many suicides? Because it's not a cause and effect relationship. It's a very chaotic relationship. Hmm. It's a very complex relationship. And so evolution has kept us alive by emphasizing kindness, emphasizing love, while not neglecting self-defense. So there's a lot of evolutionary behaviors that have kept us going and have kept us as a species alive. And to make advantage of this, instead of the wars going on our planet right now, we need much more loving kindness, much more charity. And again, being Sunday, hope, faith, and love, and there you have it.
Yeah. No, I absolutely. I think that that is something we definitely need more of, more pro-social behavior. And I think Dan Brown, when I was speaking with him a couple of years ago, psychologist over at Harvard, he has done a lot of work on attachment theory and attachment repair in adults. And he said that we talk about proper parenting or right parenting, but we don't talk about the how to do it. We don't talk about taking delight in our children. And I think that that if we had more of that, or if we could somehow carry that curiosity and intrigue and delight to and reception of what other people are doing and interest in the affairs of others in a good way, I think that would be a kinder society.
Well, Edward, I'm glad that you know Dan Brown. He's an old friend of mine.
Yeah.
Yes, and we've written a couple of articles together. The last time I was in Boston, I had a delightful exchange with him and his group. And he certainly has a great deal of insight into what we're talking about. And the work that he's done on attachment theory has really taken that theory a couple of steps further. And again, he's written on the topic and is a very good articulator of this topic.
Yeah, he is. Even his background in Dzogchen and Tibetan meditation.
Yes.
The connection between mindfulness and psychotherapy and his deep work with Erica Fromm and Steve Kahn and other people. And just so well steeped in West and East, indigenous and scientific modalities on consciousness. Yeah.
Dan Brown is one of a few people I know who have really gone into a great depth of study of Eastern disciplines, in his cases is a Tibetan tradition, and then found ways to put that into their personal life and into their personal use. I think that this is one way in which East can meet West, but also North can meet South. From the South, we have the ayahuasca tradition now, which is becoming important. In other words, this is a planet with many resources, and there are many traditions that we can learn from and can put to good use in terms of helping people and helping the planet.
Yeah. There's a wide world out there that is just waiting for us to interact with, to learn from, and have a back and forth with North, South, East, West. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, I think we can probably sign off for this Sunday. The book, everyone, I highly recommend it. It is Understanding Suicide's Allure, Step to Save Lives.
Oh, just a minute. I have a copy of the book right here.
All right.
This is what your listeners can do by internet or bookstores or whatever. Here it is.
Yes. All right. Brick and mortar, internet. Pick it up. Well worth your time. Thank you so much. Thank you, Stan.
Oh, thank you for the good questions. It's a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Okay. So long now.
for listening to the Psychology Talk podcast. Did you know you can find us on the web all over the place? Well, maybe not all over the place, but you can find us on Instagram, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us at Spreaker, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, loads of places. Please look for us, and if you can, subscribe, like us, leave us a review, send us a comment, a criticism. Hey, we like to hear a lot from people. Go ahead, talk to us. That's why we're here. By the way, this is just a reminder to let you know that all of the material here is for entertainment and informative purposes only. If you do need a therapist or a mental health professional, please seek one out. Music is provided by the band Serenati.